Hello, everyone. This is Hardy Roberts, Chair of the Construction Law Committee. This is our December 8, 2014 meeting. As you know, we're recording the meeting. We'll put it on iTunes as a podcast so that folks that aren't here can listen to it, or you can listen to it again if you enjoy it so much. As is customary, I'll introduce our officers. Our Vice Chair is Scott Pence. I know he won't be able to make it today. Lean Weintraub is our other vice chair, and Robert Doan is our secretary. You should have caught in your emails the minutes from Rob for last month's meeting. Anyone had a chance to review those? Can we get a motion to approve last month's meeting minutes?
Move to approve.
Motion to approve last month's meeting minutes. Second.
All right, I'll count that as a second. So if there's no objection, we're going to approve the minutes. And they're approved. I think we've on a run of about, at least since I've been involved in the committee, no one's ever objected to the meeting minutes. So maybe we just don't need that formality anymore. But in any event, let's move on. On our subcommittee reports, first up is our ABA forum liaison, Carrie Wright.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. The ABA forum, the next national meeting is going to be the midwinter meeting. And that's January the 29th and the 30th of 2015. It's going to be in Scottsdale. I think the early bird registration closes in about a week or so. So if you haven't registered, I'd encourage you to go ahead and do it. Also, really try to get your hotel room. That is Super Bowl weekend. And the Super Bowl is going to be held there this year. So they expect that the rooms are going to be very tight. The topic is going to be my favorite. What doesn't bankrupt you makes you stronger. Again, it should be another quality ABA meeting. And then after that, there will be a regional meeting. I think it's a Sticks and Bricks program. And there will actually be one in Florida this year, February the 27th in Fort Lauderdale. And I believe it's going to be in Beckram Polyakoff's office. As you know, Steve Lesser is the chair of the forum this year. And he has brought the not only the Sticks and Bricks program to Florida, but also their annual meeting. It's going to be April the 16th and the 18th at the Boca Raton Resort and Club. And so I'd encourage everyone to sign up so that we can have a good showing from the Florida bar at that meeting. We're also co-sponsoring with the Construction Law Committee and the ABA. Typically do when they have a meeting in Florida. We'll have a joint reception on Thursday night. At no cost to the Florida Bar, we just promote it and through these monthly telephone conferences. And then further on out in the fall, October 8th and 9th, the fall meeting will be in Austin, Texas. The midwinter meeting next year, 2016, will be San Francisco, this January 20th and 21st of 2016. And then they'll round out in Nashville, April 30th of 2016. Again, as we've stated before, this is a great time to get involved in the forum. We have a lot of people on leadership, and Steve being the chair, we're able to get people on different committees and involved in various. And if you have any questions, feel free to give me a call directly. There's also a forum app. I would encourage you just to go to iTunes or the counterpart for Google and just type in forum ABA construction or construction law, and there's a free app that will have all of this information for you on your handheld device. And that's my report, Hardy.
Thanks very much, Kerry. Anybody have any questions or anything? All right, with that, we'll move on to our ADR subcommittee with Deborah Mastin. Deb, are you here?
I am. Very short report. We're collecting members. We'd be glad to have you. We'll have our first telephone meeting very shortly. And we'll look forward to a good year.
Very good. Thanks, Deb. Next up is certification exam. Fred, are you the sole chair of the certification exam? Do I have it right?
I'm the chair of the sole, yes.
All right. We know you got sole.
Thank you. And Rhythm, I'm very, very happy to report we have 58 applications for next year's exam. 38 of them are first-time applications. I believe this is the biggest class we have had since the initial certification class in 05. The exam is just about ready. I think we've approved the essay questions, and it's now just going to be up to the committee to pick the final test bank questions and put it together. We will be pre-testing again this year, and we will be calling on some of you who are already board certified to serve as a pre-tester. If you are interested, email to me and let me know of your interest. Bruce Partington, I hope you're going to send me an email.
Yeah, didn't I send you one the other day?
Not for pre-testing.
Oh, okay. I'll send you one.
All right, Fred. Does that conclude your report?
Yes, it does.
Thanks very much. Next up, certification review course with Deb Mastin again and Brian Renzio.
The certification review course will be held simultaneously with the Construction Law Institute. It will start Thursday afternoon. It's a grueling course. It goes all day Friday and most of Saturday. There's a lot of material to cover. And if you're interested in this year's, we've got it set. Our speakers are all committed. Our papers are starting to be due in a couple of weeks. And we're on track for a really high-quality, interesting review course. And I commend those of you who don't take CLI or have people in your firm who are a little hesitant to do CLI, come to the construction review course. Very comprehensive, and the speakers are fabulous.
Thanks very much, Deb. Next up, Construction Law Institute. Reese, do you have a report for the committee?
Yes, Hardy. This is Reese Henderson, and kind of piggybacking on what Deb was saying, for those 58 of you who are not sitting for the certification exam this year, as well as those who decide to attend the review course, we have the Construction Law Institute, the 8th Annual Construction Law Institute, starting up March 12th through the 14th. And for those attending the Institute, it's the Institute's going to be at the JW Marriott Orlando Grand Lakes there in Orlando. And so for those attending the Institute and not the review course, you have the option of golfing on Thursday instead of attending a course. And the golf course there is a very beautiful course, award-winning. And so we're looking forward to a great event there. The Institute program starts bright and early Friday morning at 8 o'clock. And we have a great program ready for everybody. We have speakers on the use of social media in litigation, effective discovery techniques, surety insolvency, construction liens and arbitration, and a new course on proactive arbitration advocacy, arbitration selection, arbitrability, orders, preliminary awards, problematic arbitrators, and other issues. So we've got a great program coming up. We will be releasing, Hardy, the brochure for the course most likely this week, and certainly next week at the latest. So if you're looking for that, that will be available on the website, and we'll also be distributing that through the bar channel. So be on the lookout for that, as the hotel typically, the room blocks will book up quickly. So look forward to seeing everybody March 12th through the 14th.
Terrific. Thanks, Reese. Next up, Neil Sivier is chairing our newly formed Construction Litigation Subcommittee. Neil, are you there? Anything to report?
Hardy, this is R.J. Hoy. I don't expect Neil to be able to attend. He's in an arbitration in Jacksonville, but I can give a brief report on his behalf if you'd like.
That'd be great, R.J. Thank you.
Sure. The Construction Litigation Subcommittee held its first telephonic meeting, it feels like about 10 days ago. The subcommittee is still looking for members. We are going to reconvene. We just sort of batted around some initial ideas. We're going to reconvene at a yet undetermined time in January to put a little bit more concrete plans together. So if you're interested in joining the Construction Litigation Subcommittee, please email me, R.J. Hoy, or Neil Sivier, and just express your interest, and we'll get you on the email loop. That's it.
Excellent. Thanks very much. Construction Transactions, it's another newly formed subcommittee chaired by Clara Margaret Groover. Clara Margaret?
Before you go there.
Yeah, sure.
Steve has a brief report on construction regulation. We're skipping our written report this month.
Oh!
But we have
sorry, Fred. I skipped ahead.
One important case to report to you.
This is Steve. The only case that I had for this week is one that came out from the Florida Supreme Court at the end of last week. It's the Morales versus Zenith Insurance Company, and it's a case that has to do with workers' comp. This is a case where three questions were certified to the Florida Supreme Court by the 11th Circuit. And what happened in this is Mr. Morales was killed when he was crushed to death by a palm tree while working for a nursery company. And his surviving wife obtained workers' comp benefits from Zenith and signed a release on behalf of herself and her children. Then after that, her lawyers filed a tort claim on behalf of not Ms. Morales and the children, but on behalf of the estate of Mr. Morales, and sued in state court against the lawn nursery company and got a default judgment for $9.5 million. Being a default judgment, of course, they weren't collecting it, so they filed a state court action then against Zenith Insurance Company under the employer liability section of that workers' comp policy. And although the employer liability part doesn't really cover much, it's kind of a gap filler for the rare instance where workers' comp does not apply. In this case, the argument by the estate was that the insurer was liable because they were not trying to enforce a workers' comp claim. They were trying to simply enforce a judgment on a separate tort claim. The Supreme Court looked at three issues. One, did the estate have standing to sue Zenith? And the answer is yes. That's just exactly how these things work. When you sue someone that has insurance on a tort claim, you don't sue the insurer initially, but after you obtain the judgment, then you can sue the insurer. And so, yes, the short answer to that was yes, you do have standing. However, the court said that this type of policy where there's an employer liability component with a workers' comp policy, you can't get around that by just recharacterizing the claim, the basis of which is something that is covered by workers' comp insurance as a tort claim and still get coverage under employer liability. And then as an additional matter, the release that Ms. Morales signed on behalf of herself and her children was effective to also release claims for the estate, and the court didn't seem to have much trouble getting to that issue. So there's really not any breaking news or breaking law here. It's a general application of the law. The thing that was interesting to me was after getting workers' comp benefits, the wife and her lawyer filed a separate suit in state court, got a huge default judgment, and they just can't collect it. That's it.
All right. Thanks very much. Appreciate it, Steve. All right. Now, next up, our newly formed Construction Transaction Subcommittee with Clara Margaret Groover. Who is not here today, so no report, and we'll move on. Contractors University, Lee Weintraub and Kerry Wright, what's happening with this initiative?
We are making progress. We have kind of come up with different agenda topics that we want to have the various sessions address. And remember what we said in our last meeting, what we're trying to do here is create 3 to 4 hour workshops with contractors around the state that'll rotate around the state, and the workshops are not going to be substantive discussions but more practical training type sessions to help contractors improve their means and methods from a legal standpoint. So the committee has met and come up with a list of topics that we want to present, And basically this is a library of topics. As we figure out where we're going to go around the state, we're going to just kind of pull three or four of these per session and just kind of rotate through them. So through the course of every couple of years, these topics are kind of just presented on an ad hoc rotating basis. And they involve, you know, best practices for drafting liens, contract negotiation strategies, protecting the contractor from condo defect liability, dispute resolution, handling delay claims, those kinds of things. And now that we have that kind of organized, in our next meeting, the committee is going to try to schedule the first year of programming by figuring out which locations we're going to go to. We'll do about three or four a year. Within each location, which topics are we going to present? And from there, identify law firms to recruit as sponsors or hosts. What we're looking for is a law firm willing to give up the conference room for half a day, be the host and sponsor, I guess have light refreshments or whatever, and just kind of underwrite the costs of the session, which isn't going to be much because other than light refreshments and some marketing is really not a lot more involved. And if you guys are interested in hosting one of these sessions, shoot me or Carrie an email, and we'll start to gather interest and work that into our analysis. Also, if you're interested in being a speaker, send us an email as well, because not only will we be identifying the host law firms, but we'll also be identifying speakers to reach out to and recruit. And then the last point is we're also going to try to partner with trade associations within each location for the purpose of marketing and getting the word out. So if you're going to send us an email as a potential host or sponsor of this event, also it would be helpful if you could let us know whether you have any connections in any of the local trade associations that we could parlay and leverage in a marketing standpoint. And down the road, the next step for the committee will be to get these courses accredited so we can offer CEU hours to the contractors. Carrie, do you have anything you wanted to add? Okay, that's my report.
All right. Thanks, Lee. Appreciate it. Next up, Legislative Subcommittee with Scott Pence. Scott's not here today, so no report. Membership Subcommittee, Arnie Tritt. Arnie, are you here? No report from Arnie. Publication Subcommittee, Sean Mickley.
Hello, Hardy. It's Sean Mickley. Sorry I wasn't here last month, guys. Since last month, my article was published in ActionLine, so it's out there for the benefit of the Florida Bar attorneys. Hopefully you, as well as maybe your colleagues, find it to be helpful and of interest. And that's kind of what the publication subcommittee is going to gear up for here in the near future, which is to really push to get articles by different subcommittees of the CLC to submit articles to me for publication in either ActionLine or Florida Bar. I know Lee mentioned that we have one that's in the works for, I believe, winter of 2015 for ActionLine. And in the meantime, if any of the subcommittees...
Winter 2014.
I'm sorry. And so if any other subcommittees such as litigation or transactional or ADR have any interest in submitting an article to me for peer review to submit to either ActionLine or the Florida Bar, please do so. Reach out to me via email at smickley, M-I-C-K-L-E-Y, at Gould, G-O-U-L-D, Cooksey, C-O-O-K-S-E-Y.com. Other than that, we have nothing else in the pipeline right now, so always looking for new and great ideas.
Thanks a lot, Sean. And if you've got something to write or want to get something published, please do email Sean. Next up, Lisa Colon-Heron with Small Business Programs, and you should have her written report in your email as well. Lisa?
Hi, yes. Thank you, Hardy. I've recently sent off a written report. The report is broken down into two sections. One, I tried to put in some in the news, trying to follow what's going on in the DBE world. This month, on November 12th, November 12, 2014, an owner of a Pittsburgh DBE pled guilty to conspiracy to defraud the federal government. This was a case relating from a DBE that was found to not perform any work on the projects that they performed and that had conspired with a non-DBE firm to just be a front. The owner of the company had pled guilty to the federal charges and is awaiting sentencing. And then in the legal opinions, you'll find two cases recently handed down by the Office of Hearing and Appeals. The first is a size appeal case by the SBA. It's the AIS Engineering, Inc. case, and this is a size appeal that arises from a size protest on a VA RFP for satellite communications operation. And basically, the argument that was made by the protester was that the company that was successfully awarded the contract was not a small business company. And the argument that they were making was that they were supposed to recertify under these task orders that were issued under an indefinite delivery and indefinite quantity contract. The Small Business Administration denied the appeal. The appeal was taken up to the Office of Hearing and Appeals, and the OHA also found that the appeal was not timely and also said that that there was no need for the VA to require recertification because it was a task order and it was not a standalone RFP. The second case that I cited is a small disabled veteran-owned business concern appeal. And this appeal was brought by SDVO Small Business that was protested on a contract for the VA. In this case, the protester, there were four protesters actually, and they all made the same argument that the small business company was not owned and controlled by a cerebral disabled veteran because they found that the service disabled company had two classes of stock. And when you took a look at the articles of incorporation, those classes of stock were treated differently. And so the argument they were making was that the service disabled veteran, who was a gentleman named Mr. Thomas Curtis, did not own and control more than 51% of the stock. Mr. Curtis's argument was that there was one class of stock that was divided into two series, Series A, which was common stock, and Series B, which is a convertible preferred stock that was owned by his ESOP, the employee stock plan. The SBA and the OHA sustained the appeal, finding that the SBA regulations were silent as to what constitutes a class of stock, that SBA regulations does not distinguish between class and series, and because the two stocks were treated differently under the Articles of Incorporation and the corporate documents, that the service-disabled veteran did not own 51% of the stock. That's it.
All right, Lisa, thanks a lot. Next up, Surety and Insurance with Bruce Partington and Ty Thompson.
Hey, Hardy, this is Ty. I think Bruce is on the line. You all probably have seen through the waiver wire that not much reporting has come out in the past 2 months, in part because there's not been a whole lot of activity, but also because it's just Bruce and me that are on the committee. So the first point of business for us is we're soliciting folks that may be interested in being on the thrilling subcommittee that is Surety and Insurance to assist in programming and assisting in just furnishing the case updates that we have been doing in the past. So that's first. We're hoping to have a meeting sometime in January after the new year to discuss the programming and assigning responsibilities to those that may want to participate. The next thing is although we don't have a written report, I do want to talk briefly about a case that came out on Friday, the 5th of December, from North Carolina. It is an adversary proceeding. The case is New Bern Riverfront Development, LLC v. Weaver Cook Construction, LLC. In this case, the obligee, or the owner, had sued the contractor in the surety for alleged consequential damages. The bonded construction contract, like most AIA forms, contained a mutual waiver of consequential damages. And because there was that waiver, both the principal and the surety moved for partial summary judgment as to the claims involving consequential damages. In a prior order, the court had granted the principal's motion based on that mutual waiver in the contract, but directed further briefing as to the surety's motion for partial summary judgment. After considering that briefing, the court held that while the surety was not derivatively liable for consequential damages caused by the principal's alleged breach, it could potentially be liable for consequential damages caused by its own alleged breach of its bond obligations. The court noted that the bond provided the surety could be liable for additional legal, design, professional, and delay costs resulting from the surety's failure to act in accordance with the bond, and because the bond itself did not contain a similar mutual waiver, it denied the surety's motion for summary judgment. So although I don't necessarily agree with that outcome as a surety lawyer, and because there is no bad faith in Florida as it relates to the surety's conduct in handling claims related to these types of circumstances, this is a case that's out there that is of least interest to us. So that, if anybody wants a copy of the order, it's a 10-page order, just shoot me an email and I'll let you know. And then also one other thing is, if anybody's interested in being on the committee, please email either me or Bruce and we'll be sure to add you. So that's what I have, unless Bruce has anything else.
Very good, Ty. Thanks a lot. And also let me note that there is within the real property division of the bar, which is where the construction law committee sits, there is a insurance committee as well. And one of the ideas is that there be a little bit of liaison between the insurance committee and our surety and insurance subcommittee, between the two, kind of keeping an eye on what's happening, contributing to that committee in regard to construction issues. So no harm in being a member of both the divisions committee and our subcommittee as well. And I know Fred, Carrie, and Scott, at a minimum, are very active in that committee. And in fact, Fred, do you chair that? Who chairs that insurance committee?
I could chair that with Carrie.
Ah, very good.
And Scott is one of our vice chairs too.
Right. So okay.
Yes,
so there's a lot of
party. One thing I'd like to add is we have our calls the third Monday of each month at noon. So we'll have a call next week. And then next week is going to be on gaps in insurance with indemnity provisions. And then in January and February, we're going to do two or three sessions or months in a row on cyber insurance, which I think will be applicable to all of us with our practices and our clients. So if you're interested in that, let us know. We'll put you on our listserv as well.
That's great, Carrie, and it makes me think that we've got a lot of different calls going on specialized areas, and we probably need to start getting that list together and putting it in the agenda so people can know what to call in for if they're interested in those. So I'll work on that for next month. Okay, there's no website subcommittee report today from Brent Zimmerman, but I will tell you all that, and Brent's been helping me, we are going forward, every time we have one of these meetings, all of the agenda materials, all the CLE materials, the link to where you can view who attended, all of that will be posted on the website, if not before the meeting, shortly after the meeting. And so whenever you're in doubt and want to start going back and see if you were at a meeting or something like that, you can go to our website and get hooked in there. You'll need to, if you forgot your username option is not that hard to deal with. If you don't remember your password and you get it reset, they'll send it to your email address. So our website's more up to date, and it will have a link to the podcast for all of our meetings as we go forward as well, so you can pull that up. Download the podcast. We've got the one from last month up. Got that up within about 4 days. If you would, do download the podcast and let folks know that it's out there as a resource to them. That's our tech subcommittee report for now. The only other thing I will say is at Fred's request, we did a survey along with our attendance link to see how much people are enjoying the written report. And Fred, I will tell you, it's an overwhelming 34 yeses to 2 noes. So at least the desire is there for a continued construction regulatory written report if you guys are still up to pulling that oar. And I will say that there's a lot of work Fred and Steve are putting into that report, and it's a very useful document to have to get that all summarized. So if you're interested in this and you're getting a lot of value out of it, consider contacting Fred and Steve and offering to take a portion of that and helping it out to spread out the work.
Expletive deleted, but thank you very, very much. Send the cards and letters.
Well, you know, you just wanted to know you're loved.
Yep, thanks.
Sure. All right, next, comments, suggestions, new business. This is the vacuum within the agenda before we move on with the CLE presentation, where folks on the committee can bring up concerns, ideas, all that. So go ahead. All right, we're running so smoothly, no one can think of how to improve it, I guess.
That is a vacuum.
Yeah, it is a vacuum. Okay, our CLE subcommittee chair is Angela Covington, and she will give the CLE report and then introduce our speaker. And after she's done and before our speaker gets going, I will mute everyone. And then after the talk's done, we'll unmute everyone in case there's any questions or discussion. So, Angela, take it away.
Thanks, Hardy. Hi, everyone. Before we get to the CLE today, I want to let you know what we have coming up. We have, I think, the next 3 months booked with Elizabeth Ryan speaking in January on electronic discovery. In February, Christopher Cobb will be talking about design professional liability. And in March, Ken Goff with Becker Polyakov is going to speak. He's still working on his specific topic. Then beginning in April and in all the following months of the year, we have availability. So if you have any ideas about topics or specific speakers you'd like to hear from, or if you yourself would like to speak, just send me an email or give me a call, and I'd be happy to hear from you and hear your ideas. Today, we are going to hear from Don Carlo, a planning and scheduling professional, on differing site conditions and who bears the risk. Mr. Carlo is the founder of Florida Consultants and has over 25 years of experience providing engineering and construction consulting services. He is an engineer by training whose expertise includes critical path method, planning and scheduling, cost engineering, construction claims analysis, and program and construction management. Don is a recognized expert in CPM scheduling, forensic delay analysis, cost and damages analysis, issue analysis, and litigation and mediation support. His project experience includes heavy civil, transportation, pipelines and underground utilities, government and military, mixed-use commercial, airports, hospitals, high-rise, theme parks, hospitality, schools and universities, and all sorts of residential. He's pretty much done it all. Prior to founding Florida Consultants, Mr. Carlo served as a senior consultant in a national construction consulting firm. and as a project and branch manager for a national engineering and construction firm. He served as a deputy program manager and a project manager on various contracts with the U.S. Navy, Air Force, Army Corps of Engineers, Veterans Administration, and General Services Administration. Also, as an owner's representative, Don has overseen large environmental remediation and industrial renovation projects throughout North America and Puerto Rico. Don, thanks for being here today. I think Hardy will mute the line, and you can get started.
Great. Thanks, Angela.
Conference is now in silent mode.
Okay. Well, I appreciate this opportunity, Angela and Hardy. This is definitely an honor to present to your committee, and I guess I'll just get into it. Today I'm going to talk about differing site conditions and who bears the risk. As you can imagine, in my practice as a construction consultant and a scheduling expert, I'm regularly asked to analyze the impacts and assess the magnitude of delays associated with differing site conditions. And that, you know, would also include looking at the liability as well as the entitlement to the delay-related damages. So in my presentation today, I'm going to talk about, since this is a CLE, I'm going to go over the types of unforeseen site conditions. I'm going to talk a little bit about the risk and how they are typically allocated or shifted to the various parties. And I'm also going to go into the end with a brief discussion on proving delay and the associated different methodologies that you'd want to use when looking at differing site condition claims. First off, since this is a CLE presentation, I'm going to go into a little bit of background of differing site conditions and how they're categorized in the industry. Type 1 claims being the most common are site conditions encountered that are typically materially different from what is indicated in the contract documents. And what that means is the contract documents may include things like geotechnical reports or historical drawings or other information that will indicate the conditions on the site. And with a Type 1 claim, the contractor will encounter something that differs materially from what's identified in the contract documents. An example of that would be perhaps a project I worked on, which was a storm drain relief line project where a large tunnel boring machine was used to drill a 7-mile storm drain relief line for an airport project. And the contract documents included borings every 100 feet, soil borings that identify the type of soil. And on a tunnel boring project like that, you have to design the tunnel boring machine cutter head for those particular types of soil. Well, as it turned out, as they were drilling the tunnel, they encountered soils that were actually softer than was identified in the contract documents. And you actually can't use a cutter head that's designed for hard soils in soft soils, believe it or not. So what happened was there was a pretty significant delay to the project where the new cutter head had to be remanufactured. So I was brought in to look at the magnitude of the delay and the responsibility for the delay associated with that project. Type 2 claims are claims not as common as Type 1, but they're claims in which a site condition is encountered on the site which could differ materially from what should ordinarily be expected for that particular geographic location or the type of site. Classic examples of that would be like something like a buried school bus on a project that once encountered, which was obviously not something that they would normally want to expect. So again, in my experience, type two aren't as common. They typically get resolved through the change order process in the contract, where type one are the type that we typically see as a construction claims consultant, where we have to analyze through, you know, the escalation process where they are typically denied. You also have terms like classified and unclassified, and what that means is a classified condition is simply when an owner identifies or classifies in some way the soil condition, and a unclassified condition would be where the owner makes no representations as to the contractor and leaves it to the contractor to determine the site conditions for themselves. That's the type of unforeseen site conditions. Now I'll get into a little bit about who bears the risk. Regarding risk, generally the contract, of course, identifies the party to whom the risk is assigned. However, as we see, most contracts, the owner tries to shift the risk to the contractor. And what they're shifting the risk of is conditions that neither party are aware of prior to bidding on the contract. So typically and traditionally, we see that's where contracts or where owners try to shift the contract risk for a differing site condition. However, the risk can shift back to the owner, and I've seen this where there have been proven misrepresentations or potential concealment of information associated with differing site condition or the conditions on the site. As far as contract clauses, owners often try to avoid responsibility by including different types of exculpatory or onerous clauses. For example, the geotechnical information disclaimer is pretty common, and in that the owner will be disclaiming liability for the accuracy of the information made available. We also see most standard contracts include a differing site condition clause, the AIA, FAR contracts, etc. In these, the contract clauses, you know, are where they identify the type 1 and type 2 conditions and the criteria for establishing claims. You also have site inspection clauses in contracts, and that's the most onerous clause that I often see owners using as a shield to deny differing site condition claims for contractors. And what this does, it's a clause that requires the contractor to perform its own site inspection and satisfy itself as to the conditions of the project prior to bid. And of course, these types of risk-shifting clause can definitely cause a problem for contractors, and that's where we see the most claims coming from. Now, although the trend in the industry has been expand upon these types of clauses, we've seen a recent decision by the Federal Appeals Court. It's the Metcalf decision, and I have a post about this on my blog, but it's Metcalf versus USA, and in this, they reverse the Federal Circuit reversed a trial court decision, citing that a DSC clause does not fully shift all risk to a contractor. So in my blog posts, I identify this as potentially being a big win for contractors in that the duty to make inspections of the site now does not necessarily negate or the change condition clause and can now allow contractors to pursue successful claims even when their contracts contain provisions that seem to bar recovery. But this case, a little background on it. It was a project in Hawaii to build 220 duplex housing units for the Navy. The contract included a standard differing site condition clause requiring the contractor to perform its own independent pre-bid soil investigation. After award, Metcalf performed a soil investigation. They found highly expansive soils. They had to redesign the project because these expansive soils could potentially have caused a damage to the slab on grade of the units, and it basically ended up costing Metcalf $76 million, yet they were only paid by the Navy for $49 million. So the contracting officer, of course, denied their claims, and they went ahead proceeding with escalating the claims. I've also got here some basic risk management strategies for the owner. Of course, you don't want to get caught up in a situation where you're misrepresenting or hiding information from the contractor, so you want to disclose everything. Other strategies might be to perhaps in the contract restrict reimbursable costs to just the direct costs of the differing site condition. And of course, making sure you require notice and other provisions to protect yourself. As far as risk management for a contractor, you want to understand the contract, obviously, and you want to perform the site inspection, follow your notice provisions. You want to keep good separate cost records when you hit a differing site condition, and of course, you want to consult with your construction lawyer before signing a contract with any of these onerous clauses. Now, to my area of expertise, proving delay, I'm going to talk a little bit about critical versus non-critical delays and different delay analysis methodologies and how they apply to differing site condition claims. Of course, the first criteria when you're proving a delay claim associated with differing site condition is you want to make sure that the schedule is identifying that condition as being on the critical path. And what I mean by critical path is a delay that affects the project completion date. So you can have situations where the differing site condition might not be on the critical path, and of course that would bar your recovery of any delay-related damages. The next chart I have here is a chart going through excusability or compensability with the delay claim. As I first indicated, you look at the schedule impact and determine, A, was it on a critical path? And if not, you get no time and no, it's not compensable and it's not excusable. Number two, if it is on the critical path, you want to look if it's within the contractor's control, and if it is, or if there are clauses that are shifting that risk to the contractor, typically you get no compensability or no excusability for that impact. Now, if it is outside the contractor's control, you could potentially get a time extension, but of course you want to look and see whether it was in the owner's control or outside the owner's control. And those last two criteria would be looking at perhaps other issues like weather or things like that. Now, as far as common delay analysis methods that you'd want to look at or be aware of when you're hiring consultants to analyze delays associated with differing site conditions, I have six of them up here. The two on the left, total time and windows analysis, are two analysis methods that are a little less detailed than you would typically see with the other methods to the right. Total time is more of a trivial analysis where you just look at the difference in completion dates and determine or the amount of time that the delay occurred on the project, and that would be your delay period. A windows analysis would be a different type of analysis where you would look at month by month changes in the schedule and then try to identify the issues or things that occurred on the site in that monthly period. So it's more of a general look at the delay impact. The two in the middle, the impacted as planned and collapse as built, are modeled approaches that aren't as favorable or accepted by the courts and boards, so you want to probably avoid those. Whereas the two at the right, the time impact analysis, or what's called a fragment analysis, or the contemporary period analysis, are the two I would say are the most widely accepted and the ones that you're going to want to use if you can. Now, of course, the caveat being you have to have a properly maintained and project schedule, or you're not going to be able to do those two types of analysis. Here I have a case law from Haney versus United States talking about the built-in bias associated with it impacted as planned. The next slide, I'm going to show an example of how that can result in an inaccurate result. Here we have a slide where we have the as planned schedule with excavation of four areas A, B, C, and D, with the project taking 4 weeks to complete. So that's the plan. And if we were going to do an impacted as planned schedule, we can see that we had a stop work order partially through week one that extended into week two, and they had to do some added rock excavation that extended into week three. And what this did is it resulted in a 2-week delay to the end of the project using impacted as planned method. However, if you look what actually happened is during the time when the stop work order occurred and the added rock excavation took place, they actually worked out of sequence and worked on excavation area B before they resumed work on area A, thus resulting in a mitigation of that delay by 1 week. So there was actually only 1 week delay. Now, time impact analysis, that's sometimes called a FRAGNAT analysis. It's often mandated in federal contracts, and that's the best type of analysis you want to perform when you're there contemporaneously as the impact's occurring to determine the potential amount of days that you're going to request as far as with the time extension. With the time impact analysis, what you do is you create a delay FRAGNAT. You make sure you select the appropriately updated schedule. So what you want to do is take your schedule and update it right to the time prior to when the impact is occurring to make sure it's accurately representing the status of the project at that time. Then you want to insert the FRAGNAT into the schedule and evaluate the project completion date before and after inserting that FRAGNAT, and that'll determine the time impact to the project. So with the previous example, you would have inserted the stop work order and the additional rock and seen that impact. Contemporary period analysis, that's a widely accepted analysis method that I use when the schedules are available. And it's an analysis method that's outlined in the AACEI's methodology 29R, and it is a observational method where you don't do any type of additive or subtractive things to the schedule. You simply look at the schedule and you put yourself in the shoes of the person managing the project at the time. In contemporary period analysis, you use the contemporary schedules. Like I said, it looks at the dynamic nature of the schedule because you're walking through the critical path on a day-by-day basis, and it is probably the best method for analyzing delays after the event occurs. Here's a little chart showing the process of contemporary period analysis. It identifies delays and gains between the updates. It chronologically tracks progress along the critical path. Each activity is assessed separately, and as the delays occur, the analyst adjusts the succeeding planned activities and takes those delays into account. And also the contemporary peer analysis will also look at the difference between progress-related delays and the delays associated with the revisions or schedule updates. So it's a very robust method if the schedules are available and properly maintained so that you can use them for this type of analysis. But in a nutshell, that's all that I have. Hopefully you got a little bit more understanding of how to what differing site conditions are and how to analyze them and get your delay claims proven. Thank you.
The conference is now in talk mode.
Hey, Don, this is Hardy. Thanks very much for that. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome, sir.
You're unmuted, and everybody on the committee out there, if you've got any questions for Don, feel free to follow up with him now. Any comments or anything on the discussion there? All right. Well, barring anything else, we will close out our December meeting, and we'll look forward to seeing everybody in January. Don, thanks again for the presentation today. We sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good one, everyone.
Thanks, bye.